From NPR News, I'm Tony Cox. Today, part one of a four-part discussion on identity in the United States. How Americans have identified themselves has evolved over the past 200-plus years, from the early notion of a white Protestant nation to a country later viewed largely in terms of black and white. With growing immigration, interracial marriage, and multiculturalism, many Americans today identify themselves in more complex shades of color and experiences, often to the exclusion of any single group or color. Our panelists for these four discussions include Richard Rodriguez in San Francisco, author of a three-volume memoir about being Mexican-American. His latest book is titled Brown. Russell Means here in Los Angeles, a veteran actor and activist, best known as a leader of the American Indian takeover of the Wounded Knee Reservation in 1973. Deborah Dickerson in Albany, New York, a former U.S. News and World Report editor and author of The End of Blackness. And Ara Han in Boston, co-editor of Asian American X, a collection of personal stories from young Asian Americans. I asked our four panelists how they identified themselves by race or ethnicity, beginning with Ara Han.
I think my race is a particular facet of my identity. My ethnic culture is another facet of my identity. I think the fact that I grew up in California, New York, and Georgia are separate facets of my identity. So I think of it as a factor in the whole of who I am.
Russell, as a Native American activist and actor, identity must be an especially salient topic for you. Same question. How do you identify yourself?
I am the center of the universe. We teach all our children from the womb through adulthood that they are the center of the universe. That concept alone ensures great self-identity and self-confidence.
We giggled a little bit when you said it because we weren't sure if you were joking, but I'm looking at your face and you're not kidding at all. This is seriously what you intend, correct?
Yes, very much so.
Richard, how do you identify yourself?
Well, I don't have an identity exactly. It changes from day to day. And one of the reasons I write, I suppose, is to find my identity. As a child, I grew up with a sense that Mexicans were problematic in the United States because we had, most of us, racial identities that connected both to the Spaniard and to the Indian. That we raped ourselves and that there was all this complexity to us that was rather shocking to the United States. One of the reasons I think Mexicans are called dirty Mexicans so early in our history in this country is because there is a sense of us as impure people. I continue that tradition. Whenever people ask me for my identity, I always try to bewilder them. I remember Charlie Rose had me on one day, said, "You're a gay writer, aren't you?" And I said, "No, I'm a morose writer." And then Bill Moyers said, "Do you think yourself as Hispanic?" And I said, "No, I think myself as Chinese." I've always tried to bewilder people who ask me questions about identity.
Deborah, the title of your well-known book is The End of Blackness, so I'm particularly interested in hearing the way that you identify yourself.
People white and black, because obviously those are the only two things to be in the world. It's interesting to me. People are so sure they know what I am, but I don't think of myself as black first. I think of myself as working class and female long before I get to what is to me just sort of the blackness. And I'm very black identified, but it's like a style of dress or something. It's not anything. I can't understand why race is taken so seriously. So I think of myself as working class and female, and in the last 10 years as an artist, long before I get to thinking of myself as a member of a race. It's sort of like identifying with your height.
You know, I thought I heard you say something that really piqued my interest, that it was black or white. Those are really the only two things. Really, that's at the core, isn't it? And I want to direct
really
that to
is.
The others of what we're talking about, because so many people do see it black and white and not brown or yellow or red or anything else. Is that right, Russell? You agree with that?
Yes, very much so. And I see it as the reason that takes place is two reasons, of course. One is visible. The other is that black and whites come from the same place philosophically.
What do you mean?
Well, the black person in this country can only identify with one person, and that's the master. And that's what they have been identifying with for far too long. And
as a means of measuring who
they are.
Who they are.
Right.
All right, I follow you. Go on.
I see, and with the Chicano and Chicana and the American Indian an identity that goes back further. With the Asian, it goes back further. And so it's natural for people just to think of, for those two reasons, population and race relations, as black and white.
What do you think about that, Richard? How does it feel to not be included in either of those categories when people talk about race in this country?
Well, I grew up with that particular burden or predicament that America was described as a kind of dialectic between Africa and Europe. And if you came from another part of the world, as my uncle did from India, as my relatives did from Mexico, we were sort of out of the argument. At once, that was maddening, but it was also liberating because you had a certain freedom. No one knew what to make of you. I remember when I was at Stanford as an undergraduate, this was in the 1960s, when the undergraduates were otherwise engaged in their self-discovery, that people thought I was a foreign student. I looked like the gardeners on the campus, but everybody assumed I was from India or Pakistan or Morocco, somebody said. There was a kind of freedom because I began to identify myself in my own mind with people who were not white or who were not black, and that I always felt a kind of sympathy with this other America that was nowhere described in the dialectic.
Well, Ara, let me ask you, somehow, some way, underneath this mishmash of describing various ethnic groups, the Asian Americans have managed to come up with a stereotype, for better or for worse, of being the model minority. How do you feel about that?
I don't think the Asian Americans came up with that stereotype, Tony. I think that stereotype is very deeply rooted in the immigrant tradition, where you have to sort of prove yourself at the master's feet before you get to climb up and sit at the master's table, and you can be a master too. The experience, I think, is very similar to the experience of being a field slave and wanting to be a house slave. You act as though you want to be at the table. You act good. And I think that's where the model minority stereotype originally started. That's what the historical roots are. As far as being a yellow person in this dialogue, and mind you that Asian America encompasses both yellow people and brown people and people who look white and people who look almost black. My particular position in this dialogue is that of just myself as a particular yellow person. And my experience so far has been that it's really hard to inject myself into the racial dialogue in the United States because it's so dominated by the black-white paradigm. I have to first prove why I belong in the dialogue, why yellow is a color that matters in America too. And it's really hard to make the case because Asian Americans represent only 3 or 4% of the American population, and that 3 or 4% is not all yellow. So we're not all over the place making our separate cases for why we belong at the master's table as masters.
You know, you raise
Tony, can I interrupt?
Sure, sure.
This is Richard here. I think also there's something that needs to be said about your question and maybe about this conversation, and that is the absence of whiteness. I mean, white noise is completely absent from this conversation. And
good.
There is the presumption now in America that whiteness doesn't exist, or that whiteness is not part of this consideration of culture and identity, in rather the opposite way to the way that when I grew up, whiteness was everything that America was, that it was the thing that we all wanted to become. And now in this civilization we find ourselves in, I'm increasingly meeting kids who say, I'm white, I'm nothing, or I'm white, I have no culture, that it has been in some odd way reversed. And I wonder if you were to ask a so-called white kid what his sense of ethnic or racial identity is, what the answer would be. I think that's the great unasked question right now, that we keep talking to ourselves about our identities, but we have left this child who has been, I think, trivialized by being described by America as white. We have left them out of the conversation. I hear their white noise behind
sure.
all of our answers.
Sure. Do you feel there? Let me just ask. Do you feel that's missing from this conversation? We should have had a white person in this group as well.
Well, we should have had a white person who might be able to tell you that they're not white, that they're Irish, or
okay.
that they're Mormons, or that they're gay, or you know, that most of the so-called white kids that I grew up with, the Irish American kids in my own Irish Catholic neighborhood, they were not exactly white. They were at least pink.
All right. Who was that? Was it Ara or Deborah?
That was me, Deborah. This is very much part and parcel of the book that I just wrote, The End of Blackness. And it was these kind of conversations that propelled me to write the book because of these, the kind of comments I would hear from people. I would hear things like with white people and sort of like in very apologetically saying, oh, I'm white. Basically, I don't have anything interesting to add to the conversation except oppression and horrible things. And one of the arguments that I make in The End of Blackness after just, I'm 45, so a lifetime of hearing black people just sort of accept this ridiculous label, this blackness that only exists to establish a hierarchy, you know, of relative privileges and burdens and resource, access to resource in this culture. And we accept that so quiescently. But then I came to realize it's also a burden for white people. It's a burden of the imagination. It's like when black people and white people need to free themselves from this ankle chain, you know, that says blackness is, and I don't know how else you define blackness, as those people who were oppressed by white people. What else does it mean? And white then means we're the people who oppressed everybody else. That's what whiteness means. And when you walk away from those labels, and it takes courage, it takes existential courage. Who am I if I don't always and only identify with my slave forebears? That's very much in my makeup, very much. But there are so many other things that I'm not allowed to explore and that a white person isn't allowed to explore.
You know, I'm looking at Russell and his face is contorted. I think he wants to jump in on this. Russell, I feel it coming from you.
Well, yes. Having been a libertarian, and I even attempted to be a Republican, and having lived on an Indian reservation and continue to do so, having run for president of the United States, the first and only American Indian to do so, to have run for the governor of New Mexico, the first and only Indian to ever do so, and having run for tribal president on my reservation 3 different times in 3 different decades, I find this discussion about white people unsettling, to say the least, because we're not here about them. We're here about us. And white privilege in this country is manifest, and if you don't believe it, try to become a Republican.
That was Native American activist Russell Means wrapping up today's discussion on identity. We also heard from Richard Rodriguez, Deborah Dickerson, and Ara Hahn. Tomorrow, borrowing across culture to form identity.